The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by AIB. We see Brave and we're backing it through Brexit.
Well, I think there are a lot of people in these COVID days dreaming about leaving the city and moving to the countryside. Our first guest did just that 5 years ago. Fidelma McGurk was the CEO of Taxback.com. She left her job, friends and family behind and headed off west to set up a new business in Westport. The company, Payslip, which looks after international payroll for multinational companies, is now worth tens of millions and has over 30 employees. Fidelma, take us back to the time when you decided to leave Dublin for a new life in Westport. Was there a particular moment when you realised city life just wasn't for you anymore?
Yes.
What was the
every
moment?
Every day for about 2 years. Well, we were living... I married a gentleman from Swords. I'm from Wexford originally. And we were living in a very normal house in Swords, like lots of our friends. And we both had big, long commutes. So my husband was commuting from Swords to Sandyford Industrial Estate every day. And it got to the point on the M50 that it was more efficient for him to cycle each direction, 22 kilometres each direction in the day, than it was to actually drive. So when you have three children under the age of four, that just doesn't really wash at some point. So like, we really love Dublin, and Dublin is a great city to live in. But for what we were doing at the time and the age of the children, it didn't really suit us. And I grew up out the countryside, and we had always travelled a lot to the west of Ireland pre-children for hiking and surfing. And then once we had them, we started coming to Westport quite a lot on holidays. And then gradually we just kept coming more and more often to it, and we decided to move.
And did you have an idea of the type of life that you wanted by making that break and going for it?
That was a bit risky, really, when you look back, you know, because I had given up my work, and I spent the first 6 months really with the children and settling them in, because I also put them in a Gaelscoil, and they hadn't been in a Gaelscoil in Dublin. But I was happy with it. You know, I was happy with it. I'd worked a lot over many years, and you can always find work. You know, you have to have confidence in yourself that you can find or make work. In the end, I decided to make work by setting up my own business.
The last 10 months in the midst of a global pandemic, there's a lot of people reevaluating city versus rural life. When you step back now and compare the lifestyle you had in Swords, Dublin, to the lifestyle now in Westport, how does it compare? Are there trade-offs you miss about Dublin? And how does it outweigh maybe what you have in Westport?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one is that we had family closer to us in Dublin, whereas we don't have any family close to us in Mayo, because we chose to come here and we're not from here. That would be the only thing that would be on my list, to be honest, in terms of things that I would miss. Moving to Westport, I think it gave us a lot of other things. So there's a very, very strong community and sense of community in Westport, and also the support for setting up the business. Like, there are very strong business families and business people in Westport, and we got to know some of them. And honestly, like, some of them really gave me grief and asked me, what are you going to do next? You can't be sitting around baking cakes, you know. And I was like, my cakes aren't that bad now, really. But I hadn't decided what to do, but they were very supportive that, you know, you could set up a business in Westport. So for us as a family in Westport, it suits us. We have three young sons. They've grown up now a good bit. They were semi-feral during the COVID times last year, I would argue. But they had a good space here by the sea, near mountains and in the countryside. Right. It was a good time to be living out the countryside during COVID last year.
So when you did get past that settling in period, your focus obviously turned back to, right, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Where am I going to make my impact? How did you come up with the idea for Payslip?
Well, I had worked, as you mentioned earlier, in an international business for over 15 years. I'd originally been kind of operations, international operations director, and then CEO. And over that time, I'd built out operations in over 21 countries. And payroll isn't usually top of the list of things to set up when you're considering investing in a new country. So I remembered noticing that as a senior executive in an international firm, that I didn't have an easy way to have control, kind of CFO control and visibility of the global payroll costs. And then I really sat down and looked around Westport, and there are some great businesses here, but none that I thought I would be very useful to. Allergan, now known as AbbVie, fantastic producer of Botox for all of us in India, but I wasn't going to be much use to them. So really what I did was sit down and make a list of business problems that I remembered noticing at scale when I was running a business across 21 countries. And then I kept coming back to the global payroll one because there was no technology solution to manage global payroll.
After 20 years, you had huge experience scaling international business, working with very successful software enterprises, leading huge workforces around the globe. Was there any hesitation then going from, you know, you could have gone into a large corporation to ultimately starting again, starting a startup with all of the unknowns and risks associated with that?
Well, it is a big jump, a sort of downwards, because when you've built a business to have 1,000 people reporting into you, you have a lot of people available to you with different skill sets. And even if you're setting up a new project within that, you can borrow their time. When you start and found a new company from scratch on your own, you have to be the master of all trades, even though, you know, you may not immediately have the skills available to you. So that's a little bit daunting at the start.
You took a year to really hone the concept and not a year to become revenue generating. Has it been then like this so-called hockey stick growth since, where it's just been rapid revenue, getting partners on board?
Yeah, we've done well. Like, we built out Payslip to service the enterprise market. So all of our clients have more than 500 or even 1,000 employees outside of their headquartered country. And our technology is already being used to manage payrolls in over 80 countries. It's being used, it operates in English, but all the payrolls are also bilingual. So we have it on the system in Chinese and on the system in German.
But is it hard to sell into those big corporations globally when they're looking at small startup in Westport, Mayo? Like, how do you persuade them to say, yeah, we're going to sign a contract and go with you guys over some of the bigger operators?
So there's two parts to that. So firstly, like, we're selling technology that is used to manage global payroll. We've never yet sold to any client where all of the people that we were dealing with in that company was based in one office in Silicon Valley or in Houston, Texas, or anywhere. So we always end up dealing with a geo-distributed group in our customer base. So they don't mind where you are. And whether we're in Mayo in Ireland or Dublin in Ireland is totally inconsequential. We could be a suburb of Dublin for all they know. So really, and even whether we're in Ireland or in Seattle, it doesn't matter. The second part I would say is that you, as a startup, when you're selling into any enterprise-sized company, they do want to make sure that you're going to be around next year and the year after. So that was one of the main drivers for why we did take in external investment in early 2018, to show that it wasn't, you know, Fidelma McGurk sitting in the west of Ireland with this idea for technology, but to show that we had the discipline of our company that investors would invest in, and then to follow on getting Series A investment in early 2020, show that we had very good support from our current investors, and we were oversubscribed. So all of those actions in terms of capitalizing your company to make sure that it's stable and perceived as being stable and strong support an enterprise's decision that they can consider this new technology from a relatively new company in the market.
That part of when you're a CEO going from concept to growth to scale, you're always fundraising, I feel. Do you enjoy that part of it, like constantly selling, pitching, hustling for business and investment?
No.
Well, that's honest.
No, I don't know any founder who does. I'm in lots of founder networks. So no, I don't know anybody who likes it. It's very time intensive.
So having done then the Series A, where to next? Because I assume your investors are saying it's rocket ship, go for Silicon Valley type growth or sell. Where do you want to bring the company to in the next year and let's say 3 to 5 years?
Oh, we have a very strong growth plan for the next 3 to 5 years, and it comprises serious investment in market acquisition and continued product enhancement and growth. So if you know, capitalizing the business through a fund round is your vehicle for getting to your next stage of growth, so then you get up and you do it. That's what you do.
And is that because you would love world domination, you know, a certain percentage of global market penetration to be able to say, yeah, small startup out of Ireland really owns this market segment?
Yeah, we will. And we do for what we've done already, but we're still small in the space. Like what we introduced in 2017 was absolutely new in the market. And we invested a lot of our tiny marketing budget at the time in education of the market that there was a different way to manage global payroll. So there's no reason why we should do anything other than go and dominate and scale the company, because we are way ahead of anybody that thought to do something similar in the market.
And everyone needs payroll infrastructure in their businesses, but it might not strike everyone as the most exciting, innovative business in the world. Can that be hard to kind of persuade key talent to come join us, make sure that they're incentivized, motivated to be in a business like this?
Yeah, I mean, nobody's ever put the word payroll and sexy in the same sentence. So like it is a mission critical process in all businesses. If you do not pay your people on time, it is the first breach and the most fundamental breach of the contract of employment and the contract of trust that you have with them. So it's absolutely mission critical, but it's never something that people sit down and say, woohoo, let's invest all of my creative talent now in looking at payroll. And I say that in terms of all of the payroll conferences I'm at, it's a joke that's made at every single conference that nobody in the room chose payroll as their career. They all fell into it. But then they loved it, and then they provide phenomenal value to their colleagues and their businesses.
And can I ask, given the year that we've just had of, you know, repeated lockdowns and obviously very little travel nationally, internationally, do you miss those conference rooms where you are sharing the in-house jokes? Do you miss the boardrooms where you're in there pitching the art of persuasion?
I do love a trade fair, I have to say. I'm a bit nerdy about trade shows. So we normally attend some really big trade shows in the US especially, and some HR tech events in London or Europe. So we do miss them, because at least a huge cross-section of the industry is in the room. So they are gone virtual and we don't find them as effective. So we do miss those. In terms of the sales process, we are still selling to the same people, and they're all working from home. So even if we were happy to get on a plane, they're not necessarily in the locations that they would have been in before. So I do miss the depth of experience you can have with customers in terms of talking to them. But yes, I would very much like to get back in the room with some people. It'd be great.
What else do you actually miss about those trade fairs? Is it the bad coffee, the late nights, staying up, sharing nerdy best practices and tips and tricks?
Yeah, and the jet lag, you know, you'd really miss the jet lag.
Not really, yeah, surely.
No. I always think it's good that you get to meet the people that you're not going to meet otherwise. So that's the first one. And then the social aspect is good. They're international conferences, so you're talking to a lot of people who have different experiences across different markets.
And when you don't have those trade fairs and conferences and jet setting around the world, is it just harder to close deals then over the last 10 months?
Well, I think there was a general pause in the summer. So in March, when COVID really hit in Europe and the US, companies looked very internal because they needed to make sure that their teams were okay and their teams could go and work from home and had all the tools that they needed to do so. And at that point, the conversation was really about hardware. Do you have a laptop? Do you have the right security controls on that? How are you going to be able to work from home and have access to the VPN? It became very functional in terms of requirements. And because that was happening to all the departments in a company, from procurement to global payroll to sales to legals, a lot of projects weren't initiated that were planned for last year, and a lot of reviews of legal documents paused. So we found that there was what I would call a pause period in the summer, and that re-kicked off then at the end of August and the start of September. So we had a good year end, and I did think there was one major influence on the closing process in terms of your question, Anya, that Due diligence is a cautious part of the process, and everyone who's tasked in due diligence, whether it's in legals or InfoSec, is tasked to be careful that whatever they sign up for, you know, meets their criteria and is careful. And I think fundamentally, we are all being exposed every day to communications, and rightly, from the chief medical officers of our countries and everybody that we trust, to say, be careful. So I think there's a kind of an extra level of caution personally that everybody has because of the environment that we're working in, and that slowed things down a little bit. But I think honestly, there's far more rhythm happening already in January. Like, we can see very strong activity already in the first 14 days of January.
And have there been any parts of the last 10 months that have been a little bit daunting, that have shocked you, that have, you know, melted you to the ground, where you've had to just do that total recheck?
No, I don't think anything quite so dramatic. But like, we really had to be cognizant that, like, every person that we're dealing with, both internally in our on our own team, and then the people that we're trying to sell to, everybody was going through some level of personal dislocation, you know, and everybody had kids under five or dogs or whatever they were dealing with in terms of their home environment, or elderly parents or immunodeficiencies. So it doesn't matter if you're selling to somebody, if they're really trying to deal with a medical issue that is very endangered due to COVID, you know, you can't go heavy on the sales pressure. They'll just stop talking to you, you know, so that there's a level at which the humanity core to everything that we're doing had to really be the center point, and we had to watch that. And I think in terms of team, we have a really good team, and we try and have very strong and open communication. But everybody went through that personal situation themselves to evaluate how they could work from home. And you had to be very flexible to make sure that if they needed to change their hours or whatever they needed to do, to just really, we just had to nearly enable anything last summer so that everybody could get used to some level of normality that worked for them, and then reset the button. So I think that's still the case, but it's not as dramatic now because we're all a little bit more used to it. I'm always happy working from home, but we also have fantastic broadband here in Westport, and not all people in all homes have that. And that can lead to a simple challenge in terms of working, especially if they've homeschooling happening at the same time. We really just need to keep the humanity at the centre point of everything that we do.
Outside of Payslip day to day, you're a great advocate, a key participant in the Going for Growth programme, which is for women starting scaling businesses. And within all of that, Enterprise Ireland has set a lot of ambitious targets to get more women like you starting their own businesses and scaling them, looking for international growth. But what barriers do you think still remain for women? And we know it's very low level still in this country. What are the barriers to them starting their own businesses still?
I think that fundamentally, when you're a founder, if you think about who founds businesses, they have experience in something, or they're an expert in something, and they've identified a gap in the market that they have a new solution for. And if you're going to have that level of expertise, you know, you have a certain amount of experience, which also means that you've, you know, built your career and you're earning money at a certain level. So at the point when you have to stop that activity to build another business, you're also turning off the tap for the income that you have for you and or your family. And that is also a factor, whether it's for male or for women founders. But that's quite a big thing, I think, for any founder, because there's going to be a period of time, which is very often undefined, when actually your money is going into the business and you don't really know when you're going to get some money out. So I think there's a key question on that. The traditional science would say that, you know, most people are inclined to set up a business and innovate where they have, where from a woman's perspective, if they have a clear role model of someone that they know who's done it before, there is more that can be done in the market to showcase the successful female entrepreneurs as models, and on a simple basis, in that I wonder why, like, my secondary school has never invited me to come and talk to the students, right?
Wow.
Or my university has never invited me. And it's not that I think I'm amazing and like more than anybody else. But all of the alumni of a school and a university are an available asset as role models for something, whatever that is, whether it's girls in STEM, whether it's entrepreneurship, whether it's taking the initiative for a young scientist's exhibition project. It doesn't matter what it is, but there are fantastic female leaders now in IT and technology, in very traditional male business environments, who can be who can tell their story to other females at different levels and help showcase that they once sat in that seat and they had to make the same decisions. And they didn't have any specific pull or influence to get them there. They just worked and they got there.
Fidelma McGurk, CEO of Payslip, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Anya.